17th, they presented an online forum called Understanding Censorship Issues, a panel discussion. This was a statewide discussion that they hosted, courtesy of our local league, about very important censorship and First Amendment issues. It was presented by the League of Women Voters of Dearborn Heights and includes a very distinguished group of panelists, including representatives from the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan, the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and our own Henry Ford College. We'll introduce the panelists in just a moment. We'll also introduce the moderator for today's discussion, who has a name that's going to sound a little bit familiar. Yes, the moderator, Alicia Mazurek, is my big sister. But before we get to that, as always, we turn things over to Jen Oliver to kick things off. Now, the discussion forum that took place lasted about an hour and 17 minutes when it was given last week, Tuesday. But in order to fit it into our 60-minute time slot, we had to do a little bit of trimming. Nonetheless, the entire discussion, including the full question and answer period, is available on the League of Women Voters Dearborn Heights website, lwvddh.org. Without any further delay, we introduce Jen Oliver to start us off on today's discussion, Understanding Censorship Issues, hosted by the League of Women Voters of Dearborn Heights.
My name is Jennifer Oliver, and I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Dearborn Heights. On behalf of our local league, I thank you for joining us this evening. Freedom of speech and expression are fundamental to our democracy and free society, so much so that they were among the first rights protected by an amendment to our national constitution. We're here to learn about current censorship issues from experts at the local and state levels. To learn more about what we do as a local league, please visit lwvddh.org. At this time, I'll turn over the reins to our moderator, Alicia Mazurek.
Thank you, Jennifer. And welcome. As Jennifer said, this program is presented by the League of Women Voters of Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. It is being recorded. After our panel discussion, we will have a brief period for audience questions. If you have questions that you'd like to ask our panelists, please use the Q&A function on your Zoom screen. You will find it at the bottom. On my screen, it appears to the right of participants. So at this point, I would like to welcome our panelists this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce the panelists for tonight's discussion. Jay Kaplan has been the staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBTQ Plus project since its founding in 2001. Anthony Lewis is the director of community engagement of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. The Department of Civil Rights investigates and resolves discrimination complaints and works to prevent discrimination through educational programs that promote voluntary compliance with our civil rights laws. Tony Perry is a professor in the Political Science Department of Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan. Tony directs the Michigan Democracy Institute Consortium. Amir Zahr is an activist, comedian, speaker, writer, academic, and an adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Welcome to our panelists again. Let me explain a little bit about our format this evening. Each of our speakers will have 10 minutes to address the censorship issues that are the subject of this evening's event, especially within our current political climate, and also speak about the questions that we have sent to them beforehand and ask them to speak on this. The first question, how have changes in technology and government regulations led to the rise in information and disinformation? Second question, given the right to free speech, how can lies and baseless conspiracy theories be countered and or constrained? Our third question was, given that materials in the public education system have to meet the needs of all students, and given that some students come from backgrounds that consider materials that address some students' needs, for example, those of gay students, to be morally offensive, how can these differences be reconciled? And the fourth question, what is critical race theory? Where is it taught? And how may it be considered the, quote, poster child, unquote, of misinformation? So, like I said, I'd like to ask our panelists to speak on censorship issues and the perspective of your personal perspective or your organization's perspective, and we have about 10 minutes, and I'm going to turn it over to Jay Kaplan as our first panelist.
Thank you, Alicia. Good evening, everybody. As Alicia mentioned, I am the staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBTQ project. And with regards to the first question about the development in technology, how does that impact in terms of the issue of disinformation and misinformation and false things being posted? How does that impact in terms of on constitutional rights, and what can we do about that? So I have to mention that the ACLU is a proponent of First Amendment rights and freedom of speech, even when individuals are speaking mistruths and providing false information. And many times when we're looking at social platforms, social network media platforms, we're talking about private companies, which we hope will do, and they can do, their own self-regulation of untrue speech and speech that they might consider to be unacceptable. It's not the government doing censorship. And the ACLU has always kind of taken more of a hands-off approach to the idea that we don't necessarily want the government deciding what is appropriate speech. Obviously, there is protected First Amendment speech, and there's speech that's unprotected that could necessarily incite violence or is actually actively threatening violence against people, which is not protected under the First Amendment. But we believe that, the response in terms of misinformation on the internet and other social media platforms is responding with factual information, calling out the myth truths, and holding these platforms accountable for providing a platform where information is false and is neglecting the facts and making up things that are simply not true. What I wanted to focus in my less than 10 minutes is some of the things that we've been seeing with regards to the issue of LGBTQ students and in schools. We've been seeing a great effort just in the past year to try to ban books from the school library, often books that pertain or that include topics of LGBTQ characters, LGBTQ issues. And the challenges are usually initiated by parents. The challenge books are part of the school library's collection. And the issue is, can a school district remove or restrict books from the school library in circulation in response to sometimes the demands of certain groups that these books be removed? And we've seen book banning efforts all across the state of Michigan. Some of you might be most familiar with the very vitriolic discussion that happened with Dearborn Public Schools at some of their school board meetings. But we've seen this in school districts, small school districts like Romeo, larger school districts like Brighton, Hamtramck, Rochester, pretty much virtually throughout the Metro Detroit area, as well as in the outstate area. And often we see a similar list of books and I'll just give you a couple examples of some of the titles. One is Red, White, and Royal Blue, which is a book that is a fiction novel about the president's son who falls in love with a prince in London. The book Push, which was the basis for the movie Precious, that came out about more than 10 years ago, about a young African-American youth who is sexually abused and living in pretty dire poverty, and how she is able, through the help of teachers, to make some positive differences in her life. The book called Gender Queer, a book called This Book is Gay, All Boys Are Blue, and groups like Moms for Liberty, they often circulate a list of particular books, and they share this with their chapters, and they ask these chapter members to check with their school libraries and see if this is part of the catalog, and demand that those books be removed. And I think a lot of school districts have been under fire and feeling threatened, sometimes school board members, with regards to these efforts at book banning. And I should add, if I didn't mention it before, Michigan is number six in the country in terms of the amount of efforts to try to have books removed from school libraries. And essentially, the way this works is that there's a First Amendment right that includes the right to receive information, and that pertains to the issue of book banning with school libraries. And the U.S. Supreme Court in 1982, in the case of Island Board of Education versus PICO, held that local school boards cannot remove books from the school library shelves just because they like the ideas contained in those books. And that's really the template and the eyes that we have to look at when there are these efforts to try to ban these books. Now, having said that, sometimes it's difficult to prove that the reason, the rationale about removing a book is because the school board or who's ever in authority, the superintendent, wants to prevent students from being exposed to certain ideas. The court also made it clear in that decision that books can be removed for other reasons, such as if the district determines that the book is vulgar, sexually explicit, there's a great deal of violence in the book, that it offends community standards about what's in good taste, that the book is not age appropriate for the students that are utilizing the library, and that the book doesn't necessarily have any educational suitability. But when you try to determine, those exceptions that allow a school district to be able to remove a book, you have to look to see whether or not the school district has an overall process where professional educators are looking to outside sources for objective criteria regarding the educational value and age appropriateness of the book. So those book titles that I mentioned to you, they are deemed to be controversial in some communities, and many times because they might contain information about sexual activity. There might be sometimes explicit language. And yet also those same books have been favorably reviewed by different literary associations, sometimes by library associations. They've been recommended sometimes by educational associations in terms of featuring the book itself. And so I guess the test is to try to determine is whether the books that are being removed, that are being banned, do they also express political ideas, such as, supporting LGBTQ youth? And are there other books that also contain sexual content or also contain what might be considered to be profane language or adult situations that have not been removed? And is the real rationale behind all of this because school administrators or parents in the community just don't like those ideas that are being expressed in those books? And it's very important that the school district went, because now school districts are reporting that they're being inundated with complaints about removing books, that the school district has to make an evaluation regarding books in a neutral, objective way. And so I guess what I wanted to say in conclusion, that it can be hard to maintain a viable legal challenge regarding when books are removed from a school district, because you really have to do a fact finding. But what we need to keep in mind is that book bannings can marginalize people and then subject them to harassment. I mean, when you look at LGBTQ youth, the statistics show that in public schools, they are disproportionately harassed and bullied in school. That LGBTQ youth often experience depression at greater rates than heterosexual youth, many times because they haven't been accepted by their family or by their peers, that there is a higher degree of suicidal ideation because of that. And when we take away books because they feature LGBTQ characters, we don't want that other people to be exposed to that idea, that sends a message to those youth that they're not to be recognized and they're not to be seen by other people in society. And that's a very harmful effect. the whole other idea too about banning books, the idea that we, you know, I might want my child to see something and therefore I don't want anybody else to have access to that. That really goes against our principles of democracy. And it also goes against this whole idea behind school libraries, behind libraries themselves, is the idea that to teach young people to be able to think for themselves. And so I guess in conclusion, I just wanted to say these efforts to ban books are not going away anytime. We know that there are a lot of political ramifications and motivations behind these efforts. We know that some of these groups that are trying to do book banning, like Moms for Liberty or No Left Turn in Education, are funded by right-wing political groups, often dark money, and that in many ways, this is being viewed as a platform to accomplish political gains at a local level and then to expand that political power. But we sent a letter to every school district in the state of Michigan expressing our concerns about efforts at banning books and really explaining the law to school districts so they understand that they need to have a fair, legitimate, and a neutral process in place when a parent complains and requests that a book be removed from the library. We don't see these efforts going away anytime soon, but we think it's really important that people understand the law and what goes into a book challenge and really the impact that this has on a much wider scale and of course the impact on LGBTQ youth. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Anthony Lewis of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights.
Well, thank you, Alicia. And I want to, thank you for this opportunity to participate in this program today. I just want to piggyback on something that, before I get started on the question I was asked to address, I want to piggyback on something that Jay spoke of in terms of banning of books and censorship. And I also want to direct folks that the Department of Civil Rights, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, back in November, I believe, of 2021, issued a resolution where it was in opposition, where it was in support of academic freedom and in opposition to censorship. So just so you understand that we saw that burgeoning also and recognized the importance in seeing how this tsunami of banning books and trying to censor what is taught, what is taught to in schools. We saw that as a very important topic that needs to be addressed within the civil rights community. And that's why I just want, like I said, so just to piggyback on that, that we understand and also agree in the seriousness, in the seriousness of that. Now, from the standpoint of the question that, I was asked, I kind of thought about it in multiple ways and how the Department of Civil Rights, the question was given the right to free speech. How can lies and baseless conspiracy theories, be controlled or constrained? And, also in an age where you don't want censorship. You don't want censorship. Freedom of speech is a fundamental right, as Jay spoke of. But from a Department of Civil Rights standpoint, the spread of conspiracy theories could possibly lead to civil rights violations, as we see with misinformation about origins of COVID. For a perfect example, that has been seen to directly lead to anti-Asian rise in anti-Asian hate and bias incidents that we've seen. So we also look at with a lot of the different conspiracy theories, we also see from a voting rights perspective and how it has affected in many areas. It is now affecting or trying to affect your fundamental right to vote, which is a civil right, your fundamental right to one person, one vote. And I think that, and so when we looked at it, when I looked at it, I said, well, one, from a preventive standpoint, how can we control the spread? Unfortunately, controlling the spread, most times trying to control the spread sometimes is more important than trying to stop it from spreading, or than trying to address it in that moment. Because oftentimes when you try to address it in that moment, you're speaking to someone that has already been indoctrinated into that and really has a deeply held belief. So once you understand what is being spread, often I think that you want to build a resilience. You want to build a resilience against the spread, you know, and I think that that's where we tend to take it. Because, I mean, we kind of broke it down. I mean, for myself, I kind of broke it down. I said, well, what is it? We want to make sure that you keep it short. Because when, comprehensive discussions merely enhance the conspiracy theory, merely enhance the theory itself, having comprehensive discussions about it. But the first thing we do when we have these discussions is first we say, check your own biases. See, check your own biases. How are you susceptible to this theory? And check your own biases in terms of the spread or how you, because that will also dictate how you respond. Even if you are trying to slow the spread, check your own bias and how you're contributing and how you may contribute inadvertently. Inadvertently in your efforts. Next, as I said, you want to build resilience against the spread of the conspiracy. You also want to address it at that time. Also, you don't want to let it spread or let it move forward. You want to address it at that time. So I look at those three. One thing I look at those three points. First of all, in terms of how we look at addressing and trying to stop or control the spread, because from a Department of Civil Rights point, we look at the end result of that, or the possible end result of that. And that's why certain things, like we have a monthly series now, Hate Bias Awareness, where we do 90-minute virtual sessions every month of 90 minutes that address different aspects of hate crimes and bias awareness. And oftentimes the spread of information or misinformation, difference is disinformation is the beginning, is the root because you have a misinformation, which then, has you act, out negatively towards a particular group of people based on this particular conspiracy. Perfect example is in today's, I like to use current events also. Perfect example is in the news today. In the news today, in national news today, we have in New Mexico, you have a state representative who lost resoundingly, in the last election. I think it was like 70-something% to 20-something%. You know, we lost resoundingly. But because of continuing the spread of election conspiracy and election, actually took it upon himself and organized a group of people to fire shots into Democratic candidates' offices and at them post election. I mean, this is what's allowed to happen when things are allowed to fester and then they transition to this level, which now comes in, as I said before, we look at this from the possibilities of what the end result is. And I think that Jay captured it, in terms of how you, I think he captured a lot in terms of what you want to do, to stop this plan is actually education and truth and facts, and being consistent with that, consistent messaging, consistent with the response and consistency. And I think that to me, that is one of the most important things is that consistency. I'm really kind of picky because Jay stepped in. I have a lot of my notes here and I was like, okay, he just kind of said a lot of bunch of the things that I was going to tap into. So, I like to get into Q&A and like to get into a ball. So what I'll do is in closing so we can, kind of get to some of our other panels here. Like I said, for us, break it down into three things. Check your own bias. One, how are you part of this? In your response, check your own bias in your response. Build a resilience against the spread, resilience against the spread. And what, and basically what that means is oftentimes you want to, it's more productive to try to stop the spread, of it than convince the person who's spreading it that it's a, you know, that it's conspiracy or it's a theory, you know. So, also address it at the time. Don't allow it to address it at the time. You know, even if, you know, oftentimes, even if you're not prepared, address it at the time with facts, you know, and address it with facts and with the truth. Because, as I said, because allowing these to fester now takes you into where we, and then it comes into where we see from the civil rights perspective, from a bias incidence, that now you are acting on this theory, which now has a negative effect on a particular group of people. Or on what we consider a fundamental right, and that's the right to vote, which we consider is a civil right and a fundamental right. So, those are three things that I see, as how we can, as how we can control or at least constrain the spread of either lies or baseless conspiracy theories.
Thank you. Next we have Tony Perry.
Hello. How is everybody? I want to first thank the League of Women Voters for bringing about this important discussion. Obviously, we have limited time to explore four questions that probably could take several hours to get into. And I'm surrounded by experts in the law, and I'm not going to claim to be an expert in the law. So I'm going to leave the constitutional and the legal stuff for them to answer. Although I am a political scientist, and the project that I run is a project to try to encourage young people to become politically informed and engaged across the board. And we're a nonpartisan sort of group, groups of groups that the whole goal is to strengthen democracy, we have to get people more engaged. And the debate that's going on is important because we're seeing huge transitions in terms of society, in terms of information, in terms of the question of disinformation versus misinformation, and the technology that is evolving that we're seeing today, being able to differentiate between what is real and what is fake is not so easy. Even experts are finding challenges with the AI technologies and so forth. And in a context where we've radically opened up information to society in the last few decades, and it's ever accelerating, and not only information that is factual, but information that is opinions, and being able to determine opinions versus facts, and being able to weigh information differently is very important. So information literacy is sort of critical to understanding what the education community has at its footsteps in trying to address these issues. You kind of intermix that with the milieu of culture and values and the idea of democracy with inclusion and minority rights and majority rights. This creates a situation where, we're in the midst of big debates, in particular in Michigan, where we have very close electorates. So these issues tend to show up in districts and in areas where votes can be, a few percentages one way or the other, determining the outcomes of elections. So, there's a lot going on here. And from a curriculum perspective, there are issues in terms of at what level of education are you able to handle, absorb, and analyze different scenarios and situations. At a higher education level, the idea of doing this from is completely different than at a K-12 level or, you know, a high school level versus a secondary level. And there is issues when we think of things like book banning that we historically look at, where it sends shockwaves through people when we think of the burning of books in Nazi Germany. However, in the United States, it's always been that balanced approach, especially when you start looking at those issues of community norms versus or community standards versus freedom of speech. The Supreme Court, when it comes to political freedom of speech, has allowed hate speech to readily be disseminated as long as it, quote, doesn't pose a clear and present danger. And it's and the courts and the legal system have been grappling with this in a unique way. In places like Germany, as I mentioned before, ultra-right groups are banned. In the United States, they're not. In other countries, ultra-left groups are banned. In the United States, they're not. So being able to have the freedom also entails being able to handle this, being able to prepare people for this, to weigh these things. And unfortunately, we get very passionate around issues, especially when we feel we're not in control of the situation. I mean, being a parent of young children, we try to protect them. We try to educate them. We try to prepare them. We're not going to tell, you know, 5-year-olds certain things that we're going to tell our 9, 10, or 11-year-olds. It's just a maturity thing. And the education system is often grappling with stuff like this. You know, when we look at, and I notice Amr's got his phone, and I use my phone as an example, the access that our children have to this information. How do we prepare adults, people to be adults, to be able to weigh information? It isn't, we're not going to sort of close the book on anything controversial as people mature, but at the same time, how do we get them ready to handle things when they have to be able to handle them? These are big questions that the educational community is grappling with. And it often is playing out in school board, in city councils, in courts, in the streets. And the debate is an important, healthy debate that we have to have. How it's done in a way of, you know, just, it has to be done in a civil way. It has to be done in a way that we're all trying to get where we're going to have a democracy that has participating individuals fully included, fully represented, and understanding the diversity of the world that we live in. The United States is not a monolith. And, you know, we rank certain states as, you know, more progressive or less progressive. But the reality is, you know, what are people in those areas experiencing? So we here in Dearborn are sort of at the center of the media storm on this. But really, the debate's not going to be solved at a few board meetings or council meetings or a few days. These are evolutionary things. This, you know, this debate is supercharged, though, by mass information, massive changes, and massive empowerment of people through social media to mobilize people very, very quickly. Oftentimes on, you know, the idea of, you know, look what's happening. But we have to stop and think for a second. Really, what is happening? And to assume that banning of particular books is good or bad, there's a lot that goes in there. Like, for instance, you know, are we really preventing young people from accessing information? Or are we preventing the debate and the discussion in the curricula to understand it properly? You know, left to their own vices. Part of the whole question is that young people at a certain age become very questioning. And do they have a place and a venue where they can safely learn all sides of it? Not just one side, but all sides, because the problem is information is power, but misinformation is often, or disinformation can be dangerous and harmful, not only to the individual, but to the society, to the body politic. And, you know, that's kind of the tangent I'm looking at it from an education, from somebody who's trying to promote inclusion in this process. So I thank you for the time.
Thank you. Our next panelist is Amer Zar.
All right. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be with all of you here today. Thanks for having me. Thanks for including me in this with the League of Women Voters and my very distinguished colleagues here today. I've been asked to give a short sort of presentation on critical race theory and what it means. And it is a subject that I do teach at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law as an adjunct professor. Let me start by saying this will obviously be an incomplete discussion, an incomplete description of critical race theory, as people write books about this and write dissertations on it. So this will be basically a really basic primer. Critical race theory obviously is in the news and widely misunderstood as to what it means and the way scholars feel that it operates in society. Critical race theory is based on three sort of basic foundational tenets. One is that race isn't, and you hear this a lot, but that race is a social construct, not only necessarily a biologically natural phenomenon. This means that it is, these are categories. One scholar talked about races as the framework of ranked categories segmenting the human population. So this happens through social processes and meant to segment, and many times these categories made by those in charge to continue their domination and their position in society. So number one, races are a social construct. And number two, which is maybe even more important, critical race theory sort of stands for the proposition that racism in America is not aberrational. It's not episodic. It is the default state of affairs all the time. In other words, the critical race theorist doesn't look at something that is sort of explicitly racist and says, okay, that's racist, and that's easy to denounce that thing over there. The critical race theorist says race sort of permeates everything in American society and informs everything, even when it seems like it doesn't explicitly. All right. And the final one is this principle called interest convergence, where this is the notion that change or positive change from a racial point of view only happens when it's in the interest of the ruling elite class in America. That would be like the white ruling elite class. This theory came out from one of the sort of architects of critical race theory, a professor named Derrick Bell, who wrote a very sort of pivotal article in the early 80s about how his theory that Brown versus Board of Education was only decided the way it was because that result was in the interest of the white ruling elite and not necessarily because of some altruistic idea of equality and all this kind of thing. But what I really want to concentrate on is the second principle that I brought up, which is that race in America is not aberrational. It is the default state of affairs. It informs everything that happens all the time. I teach law. So Jay, we're going back to law school. We're going back to hypotheticals in law school. Okay. Imagine the following scenarios. Okay. You're sitting on your stoop in whatever city or neighborhood you live in Metro Detroit, and a parade comes down the street. Okay. And you see, as they get closer, they're holding a big sign that says, the Latino Pride Parade. Okay. Think about how you would feel about that. Hey, you might think, all right, good music. Maybe I'll go and join. We're going to have fun. These people are celebrating their culture. somebody comes down the street holding a sign that says the Black Pride Parade. You might feel similarly about that parade as you would about the Latino Pride Parade. Now, this parade comes down the street, and as you get closer, you see it's holding a sign that says the White Pride Parade. Well, we might all agree that we would feel a little bit differently about that sign, and then we have to ask ourselves why. Why do we feel differently about seeing a sign that's celebrating white pride than we do about seeing a sign that's celebrating Latino pride or Black pride? Is it something about the history of this country that sort of bakes in all these things about race whenever, even though these are just different, I'm just inserting one race or another, but it's giving me a totally different meaning, right? This is kind of what critical race theory is. Critical race theory is, okay, race sort of informs the way I view things. Now, let's take another example where we're being less explicit with the races. Let's say you walk into a restaurant, or you're about to walk into a restaurant, and they have a sign outside, out front, that says, we don't serve Black people. All right, well, that's pretty easy. Everybody can agree that that's racist. It's discriminatory. Even the most right-wing person on Fox News would agree that that is racist, okay? Not to say anything bad about Fox News. I'm sure they have some wonderful programs, but whatever. So now imagine that you're about to walk into a restaurant and the sign says, we don't serve people from Detroit. Okay. Now, what does that mean? You know, is that something that you simply view as a geographical discrimination? Well, no, probably not, right? You would probably know what they meant by that, with Detroit having such a strong identity as one of the blackest cities in America. What if it said, we don't serve people from Dearborn? What if the restaurant was in Grosse Pointe that said, we don't serve people from Dearborn? We would kind of know what that means, right? This is what critical race theory says, that race is so embedded in American society that even when you see these sort of words that are not explicitly racist, that race informs the way you see them. But this also means that race exists in certain ecosystems, right? So what is white in America might not be white in other places in the world. And not only is there an American ecosystem of race, but there are ecosystems within that ecosystem. There can be the Michigan ecosystem. There can be the Metro Detroit ecosystem. For instance, if a sign on a restaurant says, we don't serve anyone from south of 8 Mile Road, that might mean nothing to someone who is not from Detroit. But if you are from our area, that statement has a deeply racial meaning. Okay. So ultimately, critical race theory is about saying the history of race in America is such that every sort of action that happens in society is informed by that history, and therefore race and racism. Now, to say that your present is informed by your history, that doesn't seem to be a very radical statement. I mean, I think everybody would kind of agree with that. But when you insert race into that, it seems to get some people bent out of shape. But America, I'm not sure if everyone is aware, but America has a little bit of a racist history, okay? And so there is, race is deeply embedded in everything that happens in America. For instance, am I able to, share my screen? Okay, good. I can't share my screen. Okay. This is a letter. If everyone can see it, you can see my screen. Please give me a thumbs up if you can see this that I put on the screen. Yes? Okay, great. So this screen, in the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Michigan sent a letter to a few thousand people, mostly men, in Metro Detroit. And it said this. I'll just read it very quickly, and I'll skip some of the less important parts. This says, as you may know, this is sent out on November 27th, 2001. As you may know, law enforcement officers and federal agents have been acquiring information that may be helpful in determining the person responsible for September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center of the Pentagon. Furthermore, they are pursuing all leads that may assist in preventing any further attacks. I'm asking that you assist us in this important investigation. Your name was brought to our attention because, among other things, you came to Michigan on a visa from a country where there are groups that support, advocate, or finance international terrorism. We have no reason to believe that you are in any way associated with terrorist activities. Nevertheless, you may know something that could be helpful in our efforts. In fact, it is quite possible that you have information that may seem irrelevant to you, but which may help us piece together this puzzle. Please contact my office to set up an interview, blah, blah, blah. And this interview is voluntary, but it's crucial that the investigation be broad-based and thorough. Call me when you can. Now, none of you, I assume, have any question about who, what is the race of the people who receive this letter? Now, if you notice, I'm not, won't put it back up again, but the letter did not say the word Arab or Muslim or Middle East or anything like that. But because we heard some things in it, right, like September 11th, like this and that, we know exactly who this letter was sent to and what countries this U.S. attorney is talking about. In fact, this letter, or a copy of this letter, currently sits in the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn as being such a sort of integral part of our modern history in this country of how we've been sort of treated and singled out by some of policies from American law enforcement. So even without me telling you or without you seeing in the letter any racial or religious or geographical code words, you knew who that letter was directed at. This is the basics of critical race theory. You knowing that because of the history and the events in America, critical race theory ultimately says our present is informed by our past. And that past is rife with racism and race. And we have to accept that and understand that. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. As an alumni of University of Detroit Mercy Law School, I was thinking of all the different hypotheticals that I had sitting in many, many classes and building there on Jefferson. So thank you. Thank you, panelists. What I'd like to do now here is give you all a chance in the same order that we had you give your initial comments for any closing remarks you may have, or we're going to get to audience questions, but really before we move to that, I'd like to give you a chance, 3 minutes or so, to give us any closing remarks you may have or any responses you may have to your fellow panelists. And I'll turn it back over to Jay Kaplan.
Just kind of reiterating that as we've seen all this progress made in technology and all the advantages that are associated with that. We also see how disinformation, how misinformation can actually cause harm and marginalize individual people, individuals, people, as well as communities. And the need to fight back in terms with truth and with information. And we just believe that the cornerstone of any democracy is the ability to be able to receive information and also to make decisions for yourself. And so we see this increase in efforts to try to prevent people from being able to access information, from learning about other peoples, from understanding about other people who belong to different communities. And it's a disturbing sign. But we also, what I neglected to mention is that when you poll most Americans, they don't believe in censorship. They don't believe in terms of book banning books. They want to have an open society with open ideas. So it's so important that the other side voices are heard in this debate and in this discussion.
Thank you. Anthony Lewis?
I guess one of the, obviously it's very important that, yes, that both sides be heard and free in this discussion, free speech. But also, I think it's also important to be knowledgeable, and to educate yourself and to ensure so that if the situations do arise, that you can respond, with correct information. You can respond with truth. You can, work to, build that resilience against the spread, of any conspiracy theories, because as we see, as I mentioned before, they can, unfortunately, if going unchecked, they can lead, oftentimes, unfortunately, to consequences that now fall into crimes and violations, you know, and violations of law. So so my closing would be to ensure that you find, you know, identify those resources. We are a resource. Your panelists here today are resources. So like I said, so feel free to reach out to myself also if you have any questions or concerns. But I think that those identify where your resources are and then use those resources to assist with combating, to use those resources to assist you in your responses and in combating any time and in combating the spread of these of conspiracy theories, you know, or any type of lies that we find that are happening today.
Thank you. Tony Perry?
So I think to wrap all four questions together from an educational and curriculum standpoint, I'm going to go back about 2,500 years to Plato's Allegory of the Cave, where Plato was talking about a conversation between Socrates and his brother-in-law, Glaucon, about a peoples that were captives chained in their caves, and their visual perception were of shadows on the wall. And when one of the captives was able to break free, when they're out in sort of the cave, they were looking at the shadows. That was their reference point. Their reference point was only the shadow, and they thought that that was the truth. When they finally, over time, were able to examine and explore and find that that wasn't the truth, they went back to try to convince their relatives and their friends that were still stuck in the cave that that cave images were fake, that they were prisoners, that they were captives of a partial truth. And what Plato was trying to explain there, I believe, is that we're all stuck in our cave. We're all biased by our experiences and by the knowledge and information we have. And to truly seek truth and knowledge is to stick our head out of our cave and to explore things from different perspectives and from different peoples and so forth. And, but many of us want to prove that we're right and we know the truth no matter what. And, you know, sort of as an academic, one of the things that we have to constantly be doing is challenging and be comfortable with not knowing and not being 100% certain. And I think this will go a long way if we have those perspectives when we have these debates.
Thank you. Amirzar?
I think it's important now to get into a little bit more, you know, opinion of mine. It's important to building off what Professor Perry said is that not teaching race or what somebody might think of as CRT, which again, they mislabel it, but not teaching the racial history of America in schools is in fact a terrible miseducation of our students. If a young Black, Arab, or Latino child is young enough to experience racism, then a young white child is young enough or old enough to learn about racism. That's the way that I look at it. People, what we see from students, actually young, especially young, and the younger they are, is that they want answers. They want the truth. They want to learn about the history of the United States. Shielding people from that, like some people want to do till they get to college, is going to lead to more problems, not less. And look, if sometimes you hear this narrative that, hey, teaching about race or the racial history of America is going to make some students feel bad or feel guilty or whatever, maybe that's true. But if that's true, that's the beginning of a process. That's not the end of a process. That's the beginning of the learning process. And hopefully we can move on from there. For a lot of people, though, they view it as the end of a process because they don't want to talk about it anymore. Race is as embedded in American culture and history as anything else. And it shocks a lot of people. If I were to tell all of you, for instance, that whiteness was a prerequisite naturalization as an American, and they passed the first law in 1790, that might surprise you. You might think that that wasn't the case. Now, if I were to tell you that that whiteness remained a legal prerequisite for naturalization as an American citizen from 1790 all the way until 1952, you'd say, wow, that's the truth, right? And we need to understand that to understand then patterns of immigration and how certain things happen and how Arabs ended up being white. And if anyone wants to know that story, I'll be happy to tell them.
Thank you. At this point, we're going to take some questions. I do see that there's some questions that have been coming in through the Q&A, and I'm going to turn things over to our monitors, the league members, Laura Dudgeon and Jerry Biggs, I believe, who have been monitoring the Q&A very closely. So let me turn it over to them.
Hello. I think I've been tasked to ask the questions. We have about three or four questions. There's a couple comments too. I am going to lead with the first question that came through. If a city or school board is censoring a member of the public, where can that person go to for help, especially if they can't afford a lawyer? It seems like there's nowhere to report things done by elected officials.
So if a school board is censoring a member of the public, in other words, not allowing them to speak at a meeting, is that what it is? I don't know how you censor necessarily a member of the public who's not on a board or whatever. But I guess my answer is if they're not allowing an individual to speak, that certainly raises problems, you know, in terms of an Open Meetings Act and being able to participate. But I think it's also looking at other alternative ways to be able to get your message across, contacting the media, writing a letter to the editor, trying to organize with other groups to get your message out. If you find that, you know, your elected officials certainly are not being responsive to your concerns that you raise, you know, you always have a say in terms of your voice in terms of elections when, to express your opinions. Also, there might become the need to get involved, to maybe run for office or for local office to be able to take a stand and to be able to express your opinions and what you feel that you would like to see your local government focus on and concentrate on.
Yeah, and it's important. Jerry, can I just add for a second?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's important for people to understand, too, that governmental bodies like a school board or a city council or whatever, they're allowed to participate in what the Supreme Court calls time, place, and manner restrictions on speech. So if they have a meeting and they say, okay, we're going to have our public comments now, but everybody you have to sign up. And everyone only gets 2 minutes, and the whole thing's only going to last an hour. There's nothing necessarily unconstitutional about that, about them doing those kinds of things. That's not censorship in the way that I think some people mean it. And not all censorship is unconstitutional in any case. So it's important to understand that governmental bodies do have the ability to sort of set content neutral rules on how they're going to conduct public comments sections at meetings, which it sounds like that's what that question was about.
Thank you. The next question is for Jay. How can community members ensure that fair and equitable policies and procedures are used when school boards / local libraries are making decisions surrounding whether to allow certain books and youth to have access to them?
Yeah, so I think you want to make sure that there is a process in place to review books that are under question, that they've been requested to be removed, and what are the different factors that either a school board or a superintendent or a committee is looking at when deciding whether or not to remove a book, and looking to see what other people in the field in terms of educators have recommended with regards to books, what library associations have said regarding what reviewers have said about the literary value of a particular book. And making sure that it's not just such a subjective process whereby the only basis for that determination is just because somebody doesn't like that book or doesn't like the ideas that pertain in that book. I think it should be a robust review process that really uses neutral criteria that's applied equally to any book that is being challenged.
Thank you. That was our last question for the evening.
Thank you, Jerry. I want to thank our wonderful panel for your participation and perspective this evening on this important, very timely topic, and appreciate the wide-ranging discussion we had. I also want to thank the League of Women Voters of Michigan for your support for this evening's event. And, of course, thank you to our audience this evening. I'm now going to turn it over to our advocacy chair, Karen Jones, for some closing remarks.
Thank you, Alicia. Wow. I think this was fantastic. But there's one person I need to thank right now, because she didn't get a thank you, because she was giving the thank yous. Alicia, this is the first time you and I have worked together in a capacity and advocacy or in the league. You are fantastic. Your professionalism is excellent. Your knowledge is just perfect. Thank you, thank you, thank you for taking on this task. Thank you, everyone. With that being said, good night.
That wraps up today's edition of the WHFR Journal. We do hope you enjoyed this fascinating discussion on censorship issues presented by the League of Women Voters of Dearborn Heights. As mentioned, the question and answer period extended for about another 15 or so minutes when the presentation was originally given on Tuesday, January 17th. The full video of the entire discussion, unedited, is available on the League of Women Voters Dearborn Heights website, which is lwvddh.org. Kitty Love is up next, a trip down Highway 61, some blues for our Friday afternoon here on the station Making Waves. This is WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.FM from the campus of Henry Ford College.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.